It's January 21st, and we are opening the committee. We do have a quorum present, and we will proceed with the agenda as it is printed. And the first item of consideration for us is a public hearing on House Bill 2033. And Mr. Tett, can you enlighten us a little bit on the bill, what it does and what it's intended to do?
House Bill 2033 permits the State Fish and Wildlife Director to suspend, deny, renewal of, or refuse the issue of licenses for non-payment of fees owed.
Okay. And we have several people to testify on this. First, Kay Brown. We have three, I guess, Nick Furman, and I guess there are four, Chuck Craig and Susan Pillar. Do you all want to come up and share the facility that we have for us, or you can... and maybe you can pull up one additional chair if you would, Chuck, and we can kind of proceed from here with it.
No. Thank you.
Okay. Kay, you would, if you'd lead off and tell us, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kay Brown. I'm with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department supports House Bill 2033, although we would like to recommend a friendly amendment. First of all, the bill provides an enforcement tool for both the state fish commodity commissions and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to assure a collection of statutory fees that are owed. I'll let the Food Fish Commodity Commission speak for themselves, but briefly, this bill allows enforcement for non-payment of fees owed to the commodity commissions. For the Department of Fish and Wildlife, it adds additional justification to suspend, revoke, or refuse to issue. We have had for quite a number of years the authority to refuse to issue annual fish dealer licenses for non-payment of ad valorem fees, which are fees on based on the value of the fish. But recent events have developed involving non-payment for fees owed for fish overages, incidental catches, and bycatches. In one particular incident in 2001, there was $66,000 owed to the department for balances due on overages, yet we did not have the statutory authority to refuse to issue them their annual license when they came up for renewal. The bill actually defines overages and incidental catches, but it does not deal with bycatches. And there's some confusion among different individuals about what those definitions are. So we're suggesting that the bill be amended to say from, instead of overages and incidental catch charges, it would say from receipts owed to the Department of Fish and Wildlife for overages, incidental catch, bycatch, and for other outstanding balances owed the department originating from the commercial harvest of fish and shellfish. We think that's a little bit more generic. It would cover any fees that were owed to the department and would give us the ability to refuse to issue or suspend licenses when those fees are owed for a period of more than 60 days when the amount is more than $400.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Could you give me an example of what other outstanding balances, what that's kind of a catch-all, but what are you specifically after there?
We were concerned that someone might try to define overages or bycatches as something a little bit different than what we what is traditionally considered those, and so it was just intended as a catch-all phrase for anything else that might come up. I can't give you a specific example. Examples I have are where specifically they have owed money for bycatches or overages.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I guess my confusion is it's fairly explicit in the language, the areas that you're talking about, and I'm just wondering if why you need a safety net under something. I mean, it's very specific what programs you're dealing with and what charges are there. I'm just wondering why you need the safety net.
The initial concern was that there's a difference between incidental catch and bycatch, and in the bill that is currently before you, there is bycatch is not defined. And so we're really trying to bring bycatch in as an additional item. In order to make it more generic, we wrote it that way. An alternative would be just to add the term bycatch and then define what that is.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering if that's the objective. If maybe that shouldn't be what we're doing. I mean, if that's a specific area that needs to be addressed, and clearly, if it should be defined, then maybe that's what we should be doing is defining that category and having it specific. I mean, I'm questioning this. This clearly is outside my area of expertise, but. You know, I guess I have problems at times when we so many times we do generalizations and I think wherever we can be have specificity, we're probably better off in what we're putting in the law. So I mean, I guess my question is if there's something specific that isn't defined appropriately, and that's what you're trying to get after with general language, would we be better off with a specific definition and being more on point with what we're after?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that would be fine with us. We would not object to that language.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sue.
That completes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
The Chair would make one observation. The committee would really like to have proposed amendments from agencies prior to the time that we hear the bill so that we possibly can get those amendments drafted by legislative counsel before the hearing. And I realize we're just starting and we're simply at this point on this making an observation that we would like to pass on. It is not my in my liking to have to postpone a work session on a bill for an amendment if there was any possibility that we could have had that amendment prior to the time that we hear the bill. So if we could in the future, I'd and if you could pass it on to the rest of the department, I would genuinely appreciate it. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. We will take that advice and
that's
be better
fine.
In the future.
I'm not asking for an apology. I'm not criticizing this morning. I'm just stating what the Chair would like to have done, and I see at least three of the committee, three of the agencies that will be testifying before us frequently throughout the session in the room at the present time, so we've covered probably at least 50% at this point. And thank you very much. I do appreciate your testimony. At this point, Nick Furman, please.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Nick Furman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission, and I am the Administrator of the Oregon Albacore Commission. I'd like to begin my presentation today by thanking Representative Alan Brown, along with Senator Messerly and Representative Krieger, for their willingness to tackle this issue, as well as the staff of ODF&W and ODA for put their heads together and came up with what we think is a solution to our problem. In February of 2002, Representative Brown listened as members of the Oregon Albacore Commission expressed their frustration in the inability to collect assessments from a coastal fish buyer that owes the commission in excess of $30,000. These funds are withheld from the fisherman's settlement to be passed along to the Commodity Commission to conduct programs on behalf of the industry. Over a period of two short albacore seasons, this buyer had accumulated a debt to the commission that totaled roughly three-fourths of the OAC's annual budget. I might also add that the commission owes and still owes the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission $25,000. Excuse me, the fish buyer owes the Crab Commission $25,000, fisherman dollars, that we acknowledge will probably never be collected. ORS 576-35335 requires that first receivers collect the assessments and pass them along to respective commissions on a monthly basis. While most of the fish buyers along the coast do an excellent job of working with the commissions to collect these funds, there are a few who habitually choose to ignore the law and willfully spurn attempts to retrieve the money that is withheld. They continue to deduct the required assessment from the fisherman's paycheck with no intent on passing along to the commission. For lack of a better description, they are stealing the money. The fisherman assumes that the assessment has been paid when, in fact, the buyer simply pockets the money as extra profit. Not only does that cause extreme financial hardship on small commissions like the Oregon Albacore Commission, but when you think about it, it also creates an unfair disadvantage for competing companies that don't have this free money to add to the bottom line. The ODA and state guidelines require that commissions turn over delinquent accounts, assessment accounts, to the Oregon Department of Revenue for collections. This process has been relatively ineffective to date. The few companies that manage to evade all attempts to be brought into compliance while continuing to purchase product and increase their debt. It has been our experience that the same companies that owe us money are also behind in their poundage taxes owed to the state through the Department of Fish and Wildlife as well. We are convinced that the only way to get some of these individuals to play by the rules is to threaten their very ability to legally buy and sell fish in Oregon. We are certain that if they know that they will not be able to renew their licenses unless their accounts are settled, we will achieve 100% of compliance in short order. HB 2033 provides just that sort of solution. By requiring that all commodity commission fees be paid before ODF&W issues and or renews licenses, those whose intent it is to defraud commercial fishermen by pocketing the collected assessments will be forced to comply or cease operations. It's quite simple. Although they will be able to still operate fraudulently for a season, the habitual offenders at the root of the problem will no longer be able to amass large debts year after year that they have no intention of paying. Commercial fishermen are entitled to know that the money that withheld from their paycheck each delivery to support the programs they have authorized their commodity commissions to conduct on their behalf is in fact getting to that commission. We are convinced that this legislation will ensure just that. And I'd just like to cite what I think is the clearest example of my last statement about this particular bill. This is a file on just a small percentage of one habitual offender that owed the Crab Commission and the Albacore Commission money. We wrote off a significant amount of money in the early 90s, and this buyer started back up again and just flaunted the regulation. On the monthly statement back in December that my office manager sends out that shows people where their accounts are, I wrote a brief note on this statement out of frustration more than anything else, because this fellow had received hundreds of these bills and had just ignored them. And I said, "Frank, sure would like to get this cleaned up, period. Soon, anyone who owes ODF&W or Commodity Commission money for fish taxes or assessments will not be able to renew their fish buyer's license. We hate to see that happen to anyone." Sent it out of frustration, forgot all about it. A week before the end of the year, when his buyer's license had to be renewed, he contacted our office and said, "Just how much is it that I owe the two commodity commissions?" In this case, it was in the neighborhood of $2,500. On December 31st, we received a check for the amount in full, because he was under the impression that unless he paid the assessment, the balance that was owed, money that he had taken from the fishermen, that he was not going to be able to get a buyer's license renewed on January 1st. Our good fortune is that he misinterpreted the period and read it as, "You need to get this cleaned up soon, anyone who owes." And so he assumed that the bill had already been passed and that he was going to have to pay up. And like I said in my testimony, we feel that we're only dealing with a very, very small percentage of the fish buying members of the fish buying industry on the coast. But we feel that this legislation will tighten things up, will give teeth to regulations that are already there, and we will not have this problem again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And colleagues, as you can see, we're joined by Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Alan Brown from House District 10, and I want to apologize to the chair and the committee for my interrupting of the testimony being given here. I just want to add my voice to the concern that that surrounds this issue. These commercial fishermen are essentially small businesses, and they're trying very hard in a struggling industry to make a living. And these commissions are very important to them to help promote their product and their industry. And anyone that's within it that's attempting to break the system down by refusing to forward these dollars that they have collected is essentially causing a great deal of problem to these businesses. And the agencies that are here today will outline very well what the issue is and the problems and what the fix is. And I would encourage your support. With that,
thank you, Representative. I appreciate that and appreciate your testimony on this and taking the time to come down and be with us in the committee. I guess the one question I have for the committee is if committees understand fully the importance and significance of these commissions, and in case this case, the one being addressed in the bill. Did you have a question?
Yeah,
Representative?
I'm sure all our decisions are going to be this easy, right? Anyway, what I wanted to know is, thank you, Mr. Chairman, how are you going to, I mean, these folks are out here repeatedly doing this. What are you going to do to enforce it? Are you going to, I mean, what are you going to, how are you going to enforce this? How are you going to get the money out of these people?
Well, this bill represents the enforcement mechanism, mm-hmm. and that is simply that if they don't pay their fees, they don't get a license.
That's all we're going to do?
Yes. We admit that somebody can dig a hole for a one-year period. In other words, you can get a buyer's license on January 1, and you can start buying fish in Oregon, and then at the end of the year, you can just skip town or refuse. And if you have fees and if you haven't paid, then you're not going to get renewed. But the problems that we have and what we've seen over the years are the people that accumulate multi-year debt. The Dungeness Crab Commission, as an example, $10,000 one year, $5,000 the following year, another $8,000 or $10,000 a subsequent year, and they just flaunt the regulation and choose not to pay. And these are the ones that can put a commodity commission out of business because it represents such a big portion of the budget, and this regulation will stop this. We will also continue to use the Department of Revenue as a collection agency, and we're obligated by law to turn over delinquent accounts to Revenue for collection. We'll continue to do that, but we feel that this is a most definitive way to derail the train before it gets too far down the track.
Thanks.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me on my right is Susan Hiller, the manager of our Commodity Commission programs. Appreciate the opportunity to be here on this bill, Mr. Chair. It addresses an important need, and in case you're all wondering how the Department of Agriculture ties in with this, under Oregon statute, the department has the responsibility for oversight of Oregon's commodity commissions, and the marketing and promotion of seafood specifically is an activity, a statutorily mandated activity of the department. So the problem that has been so articulately described already by Mr. Furman is a recurrent one. We have tried to help the commissions in the past. with the existing remedies under law, but Department of Justice has advised us that it is very difficult to prove willful, malicious sort of intent to keep this money and for another purpose, and so that mechanism has not been one that there's been an interest in pursuing. We have found in other areas that the ability to suspend somebody's license to conduct business is a very effective way to deal with a problem like this, and it results in a minimum amount of expense to everyone. So, Mr. Chair, in conclusion of our testimony, we support the bill and we support the amendments as were discussed earlier in committee.
Okay. Any questions for Chuck? Just a question, maybe the chair has. Is there, since we're already looking at a possible amendment, is there any possible way to write into the law as we propose amendments to this that for those who were delinquent and the license was held up, it would kind of be my assumption that if they came in and paid up their fee, that they probably would get a new license the next year. Or get a new license upon paying up the fees. I'm wondering if there's room or in the bill to have a nice little 1% per month or some type of an interest penalty that could be put in this. I would just ask. Go ahead.
Representative Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Susan Hiller. I'm with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The Oregon Commodity Commissions have in statute a provision that says that there is a penalty for late payment of 5% the first month of delay and 1% the months thereafter. And so that is being accumulated, and is when Department of Revenue, they add those penalties or those fees in when they go to for the final collection.
That is automatically done?
That is automatically done. And then there's also, if somebody has not made any payments at all to the commission and just is basically willfully refusing to make that payment, they're subject to a penalty of twice the amount of assessments due, plus the late fee penalties of the 5% and the 1%.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That. And I appreciate you bringing your brains with you this morning. It's always nice to have somebody that knows some of those answers for us, because you never can tell what kind of strange questions you'll get from the committee. Are there any other questions or concerns of the committee? Okay, we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3033. And
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I had to step out of the room for a longer minute than I intended. When you talk about bringing back amendments, I'm assuming there's the one that was suggested here, but are we also going to look at the clarification and definition? So we can take the ambiguous language out. I mean, is that something that's going to be looked at and proposed? Maybe as a separate amendment, but.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we can define what bycatch is. We would add that as a third definition in the bill, and then add the
okay. Words. Thank you. I would appreciate that. That was all. I got my answer.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cruz. And as I said, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3033 and look forward to y'all bringing us the appropriate language that you want at the next session, when we will have a work session on it. At the time that we schedule a work session rather than the next year. Okay. Okay. With that, then, we will advance on the agenda to hearing the Oregon Water Resource Department give us quick and complete, comprehensive view of Oregon water law in all of its simplicity.
Mr. Chair, I would submit to you respectfully, I think that is an absolute impossibility.
Yeah, I was gonna say we got to be on the floor at 11:30, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
We like challenges, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to have the challenges for you, so you know, and I know you're up to the task.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I'm Paul Clary, Director of the Oregon Water Resource Department. With me is Adam Sussman, our Senior Water Policy Coordinator, and we're going to give you a kind of an 80,000-foot view of the water resources of the state of Oregon, some of the water uses, the department itself, and then attempt to demystify Western water law. We have got a pretty simple mission at the Water Resource Department. That's one of serving the public by practicing and promoting wise long-term water management with two co-equal goals, one of restoring and protecting stream flows and watersheds, and two, directly addressing Oregon's water supply needs. In doing that, we manage some 84,000 water rights, 132,000 points of diversion. Those are places where water is removed from a source, some 200,000 wells with a staff of about 170, about 150 are state-funded, 20 locally funded. We've had about a 30% increase in the number of water rights that we administer in the last decade with a 10% decrease in staff. So you'll hear some of the things that we're doing to keep a handle on that workload. Oregon is blessed relative to a number of western states with water resources. We have an average outflow of around 66 million acre-feet of water. But like a number of western states, we've got a lot of water at the wrong time and in the wrong place relative to where our uses are. We withdraw some 8 to 10 million acre-feet of water annually. Irrigation is one of our primary uses. About 80% of the water withdrawals are for irrigation purposes. There's about 2 million acres of irrigated land in Oregon. More than over half of our farms and ranches rely on irrigated land. We've got 3,500 public water supply systems serving about 80% of the population. Hydropower provides about 50% of our electrical consumption. And we administer about 1,500 in-stream water rights, and the state's got about 50 wild and scenic river segments. And then on top of the water, we've got significant commercial and recreational navigation, our commercial navigation moving everything from microchips to potato chips. Mm-hmm. We're overseen by a seven-member citizen board. The Water Resources Commission represents the five regions of the state, confirmed by the Senate, serve four-year terms. We've got three commission appointments that will be open for appointment and confirmation this session. So if you've got any friends or enemies that you'd like to suggest for the Water Resource Commission, I'm sure that the Governor's Appointment Office would be interested to hear. We're organized into five different divisions. Our Technical Services Division, which deals with our hydrogeology, our groundwater measurement, our significant information technology, geographic information systems, hydrology and data analysis. Water Rights and Adjudication, these are the people who process most of our applications. Applications for rights, limited licenses, permit extensions, and so forth. Also, we handle our hydroelectric relicensing program through our water right and adjudication, and then we do adjudication work.
How many FERC processes are you in right now?
I don't have that number right off the top of my head, but I can get it for you. Oregon is facing, I know, in the next 10 years, more FERC relicensing than any other state in the union, but we'll get that information for you.
It's bothersome. That, I mean, that is about a decade-long process to get a license. The last a decade, I think. So
we've had some real successes. The relicensing of the North Umpqua units. We've successfully negotiated terms on Pelton Round Butte. We worked on the Marmot decommissioning. I know now some of the major projects that we're working on are the Klamath hydropower relicensing. And starting on the Snake River, the Idaho Power ones as well. But then we've also got a number of state-licensed projects, and I think in the last year we issued about 20 of those. So, but we'll get you that information on the rest of it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Thank you. Would you be sure to provide that information to all the members of the committee, not just Representative Cruz? And you just mentioned Idaho Power. I was over there some time ago to look at their their dam projects, and it seems to me that they've been involved in that relicensing process for a number of years now, and have expended as much as, or will be expending, if my memory serves me correctly, somewhere in the neighborhood of over $100 million in the relicensing project or process for five dams on the Snake.
Right.
Doesn't that strike you as being a bit cumbersome in terms of its length of term and expense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, yes, it does. I can't confirm that number. I think I remember a number on the North Umpqua relicensing of somewhere in $30 million range, and I'm always one that likes to see money taken out of the process and put on the ground, and I know that a FERC relicensing, because it's the first time, first bite at the apple, if you will, in a 50-year license program, there's a lot of issues that come up, and that multi-state nature of the Idaho Power, where we're both dealing with Idaho and Oregon, probably adds some complexity. But I know FERC is looking at streamlining some of their processes, and they've got some rulemaking out right now. When we provide this information on the number of activities that we're in, we'll also kind of give some background just on that relicensing program and what some of the things are. But I'd agree with you, sir. You know, anything we can do to take money out of process and put it on the ground, that's what I'm interested in.
And follow-up question, Mr. Reese. Do you then have any, are you coming forward with any recommendations as a department about how on your end of this process that we can streamline it for the state's part of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, we don't have any legislation this year for the first time, I think, in three sessions, because we've been fine-tuning the state's involvement, what we call the HART team, the Hydroelectric Review Team. But we are interested in what is happening at the FERC level, and we'll detail some of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Our field services division is the division that is out on the ground, covers our water masters, our well inspection, flow restoration efforts, conservation programs, and our coordination with various reservoir operations, including the core reservoir operations in the Willamette Basin and the Bureau of Reclamation reservoir operations elsewhere. Administrative services is the glue that keeps everything going. And then the director's office, you can see our task. We do a lot of work on the intergovernmental level. We work a lot with local governments. We work a lot with other state agencies, federal agencies, the adjoining states, and Oregon's tribal governments.
Chair?
Just to get
Representative Dinkfelder.
Before we leave that slide, I just have a question. At the beginning of your presentation, you said that 20 of your 170 staff members are locally funded. If you can go back to that slide, where do they fall under? I'm just curious, what categories is out in the field?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, they'd be out in the field primarily, yes. They'd be assistant water masters and support services in our local water master offices.
So those are,
and those are county funded.
Okay, thank you.
I didn't see any place in your organizational chart there. Where you are accepting responsibility for maybe one of the most important functions that you could be fulfilling, and that is providing for a little better snowpack in the mountains.
Mr. Chair, we are the agency that likes rain and snow, and so we're looking outside at some nice weather right now, but we could use a lot more. We're a lot happier when we see a lot more.
I'd like to have you continue as well.
I would point out, Mr. Chair, that NRCS has a snow survey component there, so there is a federal responsibility.
That's
also.
Right. Well, thanks for bailing out. That's probably one of the few times during the year that the session that you do that. They should take particular note of that.
Thank you. This is just a schematic of the number of staff that we've got in the different divisions and our administrators. I'd like to point out for the record that unfortunately we're going to lose one of our top guns. Meg Reeves is our deputy director, and Meg has accepted a job at Oregon State University as vice counsel. Her last day is tomorrow. She's been with the state for about 14 years, served as deputy director for us for the last 3 years. Prior to that, was in the Department of Justice providing advice to water resources and energy. And, certainly the beaver's gain is us water rats' loss. For anybody who's worked with Meg, you understand the kind of energy and creativity that she brings to the challenges we face. But I just wanted to point out for the record that she's done an outstanding job. We're really going to miss her.
Mr. Cleary, I think if you would, the committee would like to have you express to her our appreciation for the work she has done for the Water Resource Department, at least during the tenure that I've had in the legislature, and that we will deeply miss her contributions and wish her for us the very best as she goes to her new job, though I do have to question why a director would agree to a resignation of staff member of this caliber.
I accept it with deep regret, sir. We will pass that on. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, are you in the process of finding a replacement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, we'll be trying to cover for a while here and then work through some of the legislative session, and then we'll be in the process of recruiting a replacement. In terms of the department's revenues and expenditures, this shows our the balanced budget, governor's balanced budget that was presented earlier this month. For us, it's a total of about $30 million. We're heavily dependent on the general fund. I think of all the natural resource agencies, we receive more money from the general fund than any, somewhere around 75% to 80%. That works out to about 50 cents per person per month. We'd like to think that people get their value from their water resource department. Fees represent about 7% of our total revenue. They fall in that other fund category, the kind of the maroon color. We get about $2 million a biennium in fees.
And before you go
sir?
On to that, excuse me, does this reflect any proposed fee increases that you will have coming before this body?
Ms. Chair, I don't believe it does. It's my understanding that this is based just on current law. So there is we do have a fee adjustment bill that Adam will discuss some later on. This is just the history of our full-time equivalents. These are the state-funded positions. And obviously, as I indicated earlier, if we graphed the water rights that we administer, those graphs would go in opposite directions. We added... Oh, excuse me.
My apologies, Paul, for continuing to interrupt you, but
that's fine.
I was a very curious child, and it's obvious that I have not grown out of that. Thank you, yes. Retirements
right.
That you're aware of, Meg obviously is moving on. Do you have other individuals that are scheduled to retire in the 03-05 biennium? And will you be replacing those individuals also?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, obviously we've got people eligible for retirement and people retire on a pretty regular basis. During the last biennium, in order to meet the budget reductions via the various special sessions, we've left on average somewhere between 7 to 9 positions vacant, depending on the outcome of the ballot measure. Some of those positions could be lost permanently. We'll continue to try to manage our position vacancies in order to keep within our existing budgetary resources. We always, and I can go into this a little bit, as you can see from this chart, we're always looking for ways to work smarter, because obviously we're not hitching any more horses up to the wagon, so we got to figure out a way to keep pulling it with what we've got. We're looking for ways to use technology to replace labor where we can. We're looking for ways to build new partnerships with both our users and other agencies. And then finally, we look for ways to streamline our processes, continue to reevaluate as vacancies occur and retirements occur, our organizational structure, our priorities, and then look at revamping standards to ensure that we're majoring on the major. I think that staff at the Water Resource Department in the some 2 years that I've been there, one of the things that I've been real impressed with is they really take a lot of pride in their public service. They want to help people understand both the resource availability and the constraints and help people get to yes. Is there frustration building as backlogs start to occur? Yes, there is, because I think that they feel that reflects poorly on their public service. So it's up to us as managers to try to find ways to ensure that we can stay on top of the workload. But, I'm not going to sit here and promise you that I can pull the wagon as fast if I've unhitched 15 horses from it.
And one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I do appreciate that. We are in difficult economic times, and whether it's with you or the DMV or anyone else, that where the public has contact with state agencies, they're going to have to just realize that we can't be hiring folks these days, period, right, because we just don't have the money.
Right.
And they may have to wait a little bit longer in line, and they may have to wait a few days longer for their permit to get back. And that's just how it is, unfortunately, and we'll get through it just fine. Your 143.21 FTE, does that have built in it the 7 to 9 vacant positions you have today?
As the Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, as we put together our budget and work through the process, some of those positions were eliminated through that process. That's what I was discussing earlier. We'll lose some of those vacant positions permanently.
Okay, well,
right.
Allow me to
rephrase what you're saying
the question, Mr. Chair, because I'm not sure I'm articulating the question properly to you.
Okay.
In the positions you have limited or you have listed here,
right?
Do those include the individuals that are not currently working for you today?
Mr.
Or are they over and above this?
No, they include permanent loss of those vacant positions. What we kept vacant this biennium, we're going to lose under this budget in the next biennium. That's where you're seeing that reduction. There's some loss, some gain, but the net is this.
Okay, so that's 7 to 9 people that you have currently vacant.
Right.
Are not going to be hired, but didn't you say a moment ago that if Measure 28 passes that you would perhaps restore some of those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, that's in this biennium. Would there be some restoration? But again, this is current.
3-0-3-0-5.
Right. This is current law.
Okay.
And there'd be probably a recalculation of a number of agency budgets should that pass. You'd have to go back through it. But what this reflects is current law, which is the measure not in place at this time.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
With that, we'll move on to the easy thing, introduction to Oregon and Western Water Law, and I'll turn that over to Adam here.
Great. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, good morning. Adam Sussman with the Water Resource Department, and this is where the Water Rights 101 starts. What I wanted to do is lay out the concepts that the Water in Oregon is the public's water. Then we'll talk about the doctrine of prior appropriation for a few minutes, and we'll talk about the water code in Oregon, which was adopted in February of 1909. So we're coming up on the 94th birthday of the water code in the state of Oregon. And then we'll talk about the water rights system and how one goes through the process to get a water right. And in terms of the water rights system, I think the one thing that I hope I can leave you with is that our work at the Water Resources Department is not done once we issue a permit. In fact, that permit can come back to the department for multiple reasons, multiple times, and it's really a lifelong obligation of the department once we issue a permit. So let's get into it. As I mentioned, with few exceptions that I'll get back to, the water in Oregon is the public's water, and it's managed by the Water Resources Department. So even though somebody may have a beautiful stream flowing through their backyard, in order to appropriate that water and put it to a beneficial use, they would need to go through a permitting process with the department. And like I said, the water code was adopted in 1909. That was for surface water. And then the code for the appropriation of groundwater was adopted in 1955. Now, before 1909, of course, there was water use going on in the state of Oregon, particularly on the east side of the state. And back then, the way it worked under the doctrine of prior appropriation is you would simply post your diversion and begin diverting the water. But as you can imagine, as more and more people began to do that, the system really began to fall apart, and that's why we got towards adopting the water code. But when we adopted the water code, we had to somehow work all of those pre-1909 water uses into the system. And the way we do that through the statute is by adjudicating those rights. So in other words, we ask people to provide a claim of what they were using prior to the code being adopted, and then we go through a very formal process which results in a court decree which confirms that pre-1909 water use. There are other uses of water that go through a similar process, including reserve water rights on federal lands. So when the federal land was set aside, there was some water set aside as well for the purposes of that federal land, as well as tribal water rights, which we go through a process to find the amount of water needed to preserve the indigenous resources that were preserved through the treaty process. Now, right now, most of our adjudication action is in the Klamath Basin, where we've been working for a number of years. That's an example of a very complicated adjudication process where we've got tribal claims, we've got federal claims, we've got irrigation projects, and we've got individual claims. So it's a little bit of everything, and it's rather complicated. Now, these are the basic elements of the 1909 water code, that the water must be a beneficial use without waste, that the water is distributed based on priority, and you've probably heard the term first in time, first in right, that the water right is attached to the land, and that you need to go through a formal process to sever the water right from the land, and that it needs to be used at least once every 5 years. Now, the term beneficial use, on the slide here, I give you some examples of types of beneficial uses. A number of beneficial uses are described specifically in statute, but there's a number of beneficial uses that are not. The statute is not all-inclusive of beneficial uses. And again, some examples: irrigation, domestic, municipal, and then we'll talk later about in-stream flows. This is an amount of water dedicated to stay in the stream.
Adam?
Yes.
When we look at these beneficial uses and we go back to the initial water law that we developed, the in-stream use was not, correct me if I'm wrong, was not considered in the initial laws that the state had, the 1909 laws.
Chair Jensen, that's correct. In fact, the beneficial use of keeping water in stream for various values, recreation, riparian management, was not a statutory beneficial use until 1987, when we established the in-stream water right law.
The other that you have, industrial, domestic, municipal, and irrigation, were, however, all in the original law, or were there some of those added? What was the original beneficial use?
Well, Chair Jensen, I don't think I could recite the list at this time, but what I would say is that Oregon law is a wonderful thing, and there's various places in the statute that were adopted at various times that describe lists of uses as beneficial uses, and so they're all over the statute, but there was a list, but I couldn't recite that, but I would imagine it included things like irrigation, industrial, municipal, those types of uses. I do want to step back and say, in terms of keeping water in stream, that while the In-Stream Water Act was adopted in 1987, prior to that, even as early as the mid-50s, the state began to recognize the benefit of keeping water in stream, and we had things called minimum perennial stream flows, but it wasn't until 1987, with the adoption of the In-Stream Water Right Act, that basically a right to keep water in stream and an out-of-stream right were put on really equal footing in terms of being a beneficial use and being regulated by priority. This is a schematic about the priority system. Again, first in time, first in right. And in this example, the downstream user is the senior user. The upstream user is junior, coming after some 60 years. And the point is that the senior user, when the water gets low, the senior user can make a call on the water until their right is completely satisfied. And so the junior upstream user would be regulated off until the senior right is satisfied. This is the concept of appurtenancy. And again, I mentioned a water right is appurtenant. It's stuck to the land. And if the land is sold, the water right stays with the land, and the only way to move that water right off the property is to go through a formal process. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the priority on the senior water right, until their right is satisfied, how frequently can they do that? I mean, if I'm the senior water right owner, can I deny the junior right access to the water? How frequently can I do that? Is that, do you understand my question?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, it could be every day.
Okay.
I mean, I guess to the extent that the senior user was within the terms and conditions of their water right in terms of a total volume of water over the season and the rate of water that they could divert, to the extent that they were within those parameters, it could be every single day of, say, the irrigation season.
Right. Thank you.
I think we finished a pertinency. I just want to say again that the way to get it off the land is through a formal process called a water right transfer, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think the important part about a water right transfer is that we need to be very careful as a department when we're moving a water right from one place to another, or a point of diversion from one place to another, that we need to be careful about protecting the existing water users on the system. And again, the water must be...
colleagues, that the transfer issues have become more important, I think, in recent years, for varieties of reasons and circumstances, and we almost assuredly every session will see some kind of legislation dealing with the issue of transfers of the water.
And I'd say even more specific, point of diversion has become a major issue, especially relative to ESA and some things like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, I think it really is important as an irrigator myself. In this particular agricultural climate and the issues we have regarding water and market conditions combined at the same time, that we have maximum flexibility from the department as a matter of policy within this state so that we can move those around just because it seems to work the very best. And as long as we protect the water users that have the oldest right and still allow flexibility for neighbors to trade water on certain years when one neighbor's growing a crop and the other neighbor isn't, that seems to be the best way to approach this in terms of a user's standpoint as myself being a farmer. And I'll tell you that the flexibility that you've demonstrated in the last two or three years has been appreciated on my and from a lot of my neighbors. We appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, we appreciate that. We've got a rule advisory committee on transfers that had been working the last year, and we've got a number of administrative changes that we're proposing through rulemaking right now. I think we're out during the public comment period, and so we're hoping to do everything we can within current law to fine-tune things and make that process easier, because as the chair indicated, Oregon is catching up with the rest of the West in terms of becoming a fully appropriated state, and the way that you address new water needs or changing markets is have a system to help move water around without injuring other water right holders.
And I just, before I ask them to move on, want to emphasize that, you know, what they're presenting for us here in some ways, each of these items seems relatively simple. But when we get to a particular item, every one of them has a lot of subtleties and complications that go in it. We will be asking you to dig your way through as we come to some of the possible proposed legislation. So, I guess we probably have a graduate course available from the department on each one of the issues that we're talking about, and you will be the recipients of that as you proceed through the rest of the session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've always wanted a doctorate. I appreciate that.
We'll get there.
Okay. Move on. So again, the last point of the major elements of the water code is that the water needs to be used. If the water use goes for five consecutive years without beneficial use, then the water right would be subject to cancellation. And it not only does it need to be used, but it needs to be used within the terms and conditions of the water right as well. Now, during the session, you'll probably hear a bunch of terms, so I thought I'd just throw them out at you today so you start getting familiar with them. Whenever we're talking about water rights, there's going to be a source of water from a stream or from groundwater. There's also going to be on that water right a type of beneficial use, which we showed earlier. There'll be a point of diversion, which is where you take water from a surface source, or a point of appropriation, which is where you take water from a groundwater source. And then, of course, there's a place of use, which is often described by township, range, and section. Now, just again, kind of flying a mile high and going over quickly over the permit system, the way it works is that an applicant submits an application, and at that time, when the application is deemed complete, they get a tentative priority date, which would be the date, which would be their place in line on the system. And after an evaluation to ensure that water is available for that user, that it won't injure other water users on the stream, and look at other public interest factors, a permit would be issued, and a permit is really a green light to begin the development of the water use. Typically, there's a five-year opportunity to develop the water use once the permit is issued, and after you're complete with your development, you go through a process of proving up. In other words, you've developed the water use, and now you hire a surveyor to come out and to demonstrate, to write a little report, basically, showing what you've done and how you've done it. And upon review of that, the department issues a water right certificate, which is vesting of the water right. Now, a number of people don't complete the water use within the five-year window first provided to them. And this is, again, another example of a permit coming back to the department in something called a permit extension. So if you haven't made proof in 5 years, you can come in and make an application and request an additional period of time to develop the water use, and we get quite a few permit extensions. And once a certificate is issued, just to give you an idea of the routes that could take, a number of certificates, and I'll show you some numbers in a few minutes, end up in water right transfers, as was mentioned, as a good way to move water around. And some end up in a cancellation process, but that's a pretty small number.
Mr. Chair, may I just ask a clarification?
Yes.
I'm trying to relate. I can't relate to farming, but I can relate to the situation in Wilsonville where they were using the water from the Willamette River. So tell me how they would first apply, right? Just go through the process for me, if you would.
So an applicant would submit an application and along with a fee and a map describing how they're going to use the water and where they're going to use it. And we would review that application. It's actually, I left out some of the more intricate steps here. Mm-hmm. It's a very iterative mm-hmm. process mm-hmm. where we give sort of an initial evaluation of whether it meets statutory and rule criteria. We also look to ensure that there's going to be water available for that water user. Once we determine that it's a green light, we, the department, issues a proposed order saying this is the permit that we propose to issue. There's a public process where both the applicant and the public can engage with the department to raise issues or concerns about the water use. And once we move through that process, the permit is then issued. And that permit is a green light to begin the development of the water use. Some people may construct their well, say, before that, but the permit is the green light to begin the beneficial use. In that case, it would be municipal water use. Mm-hmm. You usually have a five-year window under the permit to fully develop the water use.
So they were, say, in Wilsonville, they would have built their their project to hold the water, right?
Right.
And within this 5 years, right?
Right. Chair Jensen, Representative Tamai, I think in Wilsonville's case, that permit was issued sometime in the 80s.
Yeah.
So they obviously got in the door before they had to go through a lot of consultation and so forth, and then they held it through extensions. And then once they developed the water treatment plant, that was when they could actually start using the water. Their problem there wasn't developing the diversion structure, but it was actually putting in a treatment plant, getting a bond through, getting the voter acceptance for the treatment plant. So that was an older right that they've developed, and then they'll be allowed to grow into that right.
Okay. So at what point in the process are they? Excuse me.
They're working under a permit, and on this chart, they'd be in this process of proving up. Now, municipal rights are kind of a unique character. They've got some unique characteristics, and they're allowed to what we call grow into those rights. They usually get a pretty large right in order to cover their maximum use, and as they expand their service area, they start utilizing more and more of that right. They go through an extension process.
They're in the proving up point,
right.
And then they get the certificate.
Right, and they're the one water user, Chair Jensen, Representative Tamai, that is allowed to do what we call a partial perfection. A portion of their water right, they can move into the certificate status, whereas everyone else, you got to wait until you do a complete development. If you're irrigating 40 acres, you either go through the extensions or develop the 40 acres and then get a certificate for 40. But municipalities have got a number of characteristics. Adam worked real hard on our extension rules here just recently, and maybe you can add some more detail if you're interested.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Jensen, Representative Tamayo, I think this is an excellent example of how you take a 1909 code, which at that time it was really realistic to get a permit and have 5 years to develop it. And then you look in today's world to get a permit and to go through all the process of developing a municipal water system in 5 years is probably impossible. So we're still trying to mix a very old code with some modern circumstances. And in this case, the permit extension is how the municipality can get more time to develop the permit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, question about that. Has there been discussion about revisiting the five-year period since it is, like you said, a bit antiquated in its in that back in the early turn of the century, it was used probably well within the limit. The second part of the question is, what percentage, maybe excluding municipal permit requests, what percentage of permits that we issue do you see where you have to provide an extension?
Representative Dingfelder, the first question in terms of the five-year, the department doesn't have any legislative proposal to revisit the five-year. I would point out that in statute there is, as an example, there's a 10-year development window for the construction of a municipal reservoir, which is more of a contemporary statute. So there is some recognition. But at this point, I'm not aware of anyone proposing to change the five-year provision. I don't have to know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, in terms of the number of permits that require extensions, I don't have that information with me right now, but we'll add that to our other list of information. And that would be something that if you're looking at extending the five-year period would be material to that. If we're just creating work with it. The five-year period is kind of an historic relic of Western water law. The idea was is that people, they didn't want people to tie up water without being serious about developing it because there were other people in line that needed it. So there's pros and cons to it, but we're not necessarily in that situation anymore.
Thank you.
With the department and with the committee, you would understand this as want to understand this has been a heartburn for the chair since I've been in the legislature, and I noted in the testimony that there was some recognition on the part of the department that as far as municipalities are concerned that the 5 year perhaps didn't fit because of the, the growth sort of thing. And therefore the 1909, laws were somewhat inappropriate. The chair would respectfully submit that the same thing applies today as far as irrigation use is concerned, that in a number of the projects, at least in his former district, in one of the projects in his former legislative district, a five-year development of that project would have been extremely difficult to have lived with, and it's no longer a developing necessarily no longer developing a 40-acre plot someplace, but maybe a 22,000-acre farm someplace.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to anticipate being able to do that in a five-year period of time would be to anticipate an incredible amount of resources necessary to be able to pull such a thing off. So we do need to recognize that the scene has changed since 1909 and that some of the things we are still living with are plaguing us, partially because it is, in some of these areas, very difficult to change the law because of so many different interests and different groups that are involved with this. So So much for the chair's pet peeve on this. You undoubtedly will hear about it again before the session is over.
Okay. We did earlier mention these other types of water rights called in-stream water rights, and just again a couple points about them. These can be there are three state agencies that can apply for in-stream water rights: the Parks and Recreation Department, Department of Environmental Quality, and Fish and Wildlife Department. And then we go through a similar process that I outlined earlier. And again, it's a water right to leave water in the stream for those types of beneficial purposes, has a priority date, and by statute is on equal standing with an out-of-stream use. There are about 1,400 in-stream water rights throughout the state, and this just gives you an idea of kind of how they're distributed around the state. I talked earlier about, with few exceptions, you need a permit to appropriate the public's water, and this is one of those exceptions. There are in statute, statutorily exempt uses of groundwater, and this is just a list of some of those uses: domestic uses, commercial uses, and the watering of lawn and gardens of up to about 1/2 acre. So those are uses of groundwater that do not require a permit from the department. There's also uses of surface water that don't require a permit from the department. Here's an example of livestock watering on the stream. There's also in the statute an exemption for livestock watering off the stream under certain circumstances. If you needed the surface water for emergency firefighting or for certain land management practices to conserve soil or improve water quality, those can be initiated without a permit. I want to just go back and talk about water rights more specifically, and again, just trying to impress upon you that once the department issues a permit, it can come back to us for a number of different transactions, including permit extensions, certificates, and a water right transfer. And I wanted to, before I got into that, just take a kind of a side journey and give you some idea of the opportunity for new water appropriations in the state of Oregon. Now, remember, this is a snapshot of the month of February, and what this is showing, the bluish green color is showing you areas of the state where water would be available for appropriation. And typically in the month of February, that type of appropriation would be to store water either in the ground, in the channel, or off the channel for use later in the season. And so in February, you can see there's a pretty good opportunity in the state to store water for use later in the year. But the story changes a little bit when you go to August. And again, the bluish green are places where water might be available for appropriation, and the brown are areas where water is not available for appropriation. And so you can see that the opportunity to stick up a pump in a creek in August in most of the state of Oregon is not a very good opportunity. And as many people that work in this arena have said, all the easy water is gone. And so in order to develop new water uses, we need to be more creative about storing the water so that it can be used in the time of year when it's needed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfeller.
I have a question about over-appropriation and what percentage of, or what, how many basins in the state are over-appropriated, and then how do you deal with people who come to you with permit applications in over-appropriated basins?
You'll have.
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, depending on what your definition of over-appropriation is if it's that there's not water available for new uses, this map here would show you an 80% exceedance, which means water available 8 out of 10 years. There's only water available for direct flow purposes in August in very limited areas of the state, primarily the Willamette Basin and a few of the coastal streams, and it looks like one of the Northeast Oregon streams as well. We review all permit applications on an 80% exceedance basis in order to ensure that if we issue a water right to someone, there actually is going to be water available at least 8 out of 10 years. That's what we try to do to protect that kind of investment. And it also protects the existing users from having to rely on our regulatory program to ensure that new uses don't affect them. So it's a policy that's in the interest of both the applicants and existing users. A lot of the reason why water isn't available is obviously it's been dedicated to both out-of-stream and in-stream uses. If you're asking, do we have basins where rivers are going dry, we try to keep those to a minimum. I remember hearing from the state engineer in New Mexico, he said they had three classes of rivers in New Mexico, fishable, swimmable, and drivable. We try to keep the drivables to a minimum, and we're working hard on restoring flows with our water users using a number of tools that the legislature's given us in the last year. I think we processed 225 in-stream leases and transfers to try to do flow restoration. We're working like up in the Walla Walla with water users on some bypass flows. Of course, a lot of it depends on what kind of climate year we get to. 1999, we did excellent around the state. We weren't over-appropriated at all. We just had an extremely wet year. 2001, we were regulating back, Representative Schaufler, we were regulating rights back into the 1860s. So anybody who came after that didn't get water after, you know, early July or so. So, again, it's kind of climate-driven. We've got this policy in place now to try to ensure that we don't exacerbate the problem, if you will, and we also are interested, as Adam indicated, in trying to find ways to use water that's available during the wintertime via various surface groundwater storage techniques and then using our transfers and conservation programs to make it available.
Thank you.
Representative Dinkfeld.
I was just thanking him for his answer.
Just a point of some observation. We will be dealing with some legislation this time on this water storage issue that will be coming to us. And it's a somewhat of a like other things here, it's not simple, but complex problem that is difficult to weave our way through sometimes. My predecessor, Chuck Norris, who some of you may know, and I'm sure you do, Pete, one of his really big issues while he sat in this particular chair was water storage. And he is still, if you ever have a chance to meet him, if you don't know him, you'll be cautious not to mention that topic because he is capable of going on at some length about the issue and the criticalness of doing this. So I do want to advise you that this is one area that we will be dealing with, and we haven't, I don't think, gotten where we want to go yet, but we do need to look into this as far as the state is concerned, where we can store water without having other adverse effects for use at a time when the water is needed on the ground someplace where there is a beneficial use and not sending it out to the Pacific Ocean or providing some sort of an aquifer, you know, down to California for them to use our water. I did have a kind of question, though. If I came to you as for a water permit and I really didn't, need the 80% formula that you have as far as use. And I said, if I only have one out of every 5 years or two out of every 10 years, would you issue a permit on that basis?
Chair Jensen, for storage purposes, we've been using a rule of thumb of one out every two, but we do go below that. We've had ones where people have said, I'm willing to take the risk that I'll only be able to fill this storage one out every 10 years. For direct flow, the presumption that it's in the public interest is if water is available. If you're able to overcome that presumption when water isn't available, that opportunity is there for you to make that argument that I've got a use that can survive, one out of 4 years. We just want to make sure that you know, we're both protecting your investment, not creating unrealistic expectations, and protecting other users. So it's there to make your case.
I just wanted to run through some numbers and facts for you just to get a feel for kind of the department's workload and what comes at us. This is a graph that shows the number of applications for permits that we get each year. You can see it varies from over 1,000. Last year, we had 615 applications for permits. And over the last 10 years, we've had an average of about 575 permits brought to the department, applications for permits to the department each year. And I think we've set ourselves pretty good up. We've set ourselves up pretty good to describe this slide, which really shows where the major activity at the department is. And you can see that the big chunk of our work is in groundwater applications, because we showed the surface water is largely unavailable. And we've also, the majority of our work is in permits for reservoirs. We have what we call large reservoirs and alternate reservoirs. An alternate reservoir is a reservoir. It's just an alternate expedited process for a smaller reservoir. As is typical, this is for the year 2002. The majority of our applications were for irrigation. I think we've been seeing a lot more smaller irrigation uses, irrigation from stored water, irrigation from groundwater. We also had a big load of permit applications for livestock ponds, which is that livestock wildlife category that you see there. And then the miscellaneous category all the way over to the right are for multiple uses of water combined, recreation and irrigation, or irrigation and aesthetics. That's kind of a demonstration of what we get thrown at us. In terms of our approval rate by water right type, you can see our approval rates are pretty high, mostly in the 90%, and I like to attribute that to a few things. One is that the department has placed a much greater emphasis on pre-application conferences, so we can sit down with a potential water user and show them some of the pictures that we showed you, that you can't put a pump in the stream in August, but you might be able to use groundwater, you might be able to store water, and we work with people to try to find a solution that fits their needs. We also have just a great field staff presence, very knowledgeable field staff that can convey these facts to potential water users out in the field. And we also have a very iterative process. So as you go through the permit process, you get a pretty good idea of this is what you've asked for, but this is what we can do. And it really allows the department and a potential water user to get together and try to work through, is there a way to make this work?
Adam, if you went back to your previous slide, could you explain to the committee the difference between irrigation and agriculture?
Well, an irrigation right, Chair Jensen, members of the committee, an irrigation right would be strictly something that you would use during the irrigation season to artificially apply water to promote growth. That would be irrigation. But in Oregon, we have, for example, a huge nursery industry, which may require you to use water at other times of the year outside of the irrigation season. For example, you might need water in the wintertime to apply fertilizer or chemicals, or you might need water for types of frost protection. You might need water if you're a dairy, which would be considered an agricultural use, to wash out the barn, to other types of activities associated with that agricultural activity that aren't necessarily providing water to plants for growth.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I talked a little earlier about water rights coming back. They keep coming back for extensions, for proving up, and they also come back for a certificate. This would be the final stop in the proving up and vesting of a water right. And you could see from this graph, we have a huge workload of certificates at the department. We've gotten back to levels that we had in about 1997, so we're making some pretty good progress in chipping away at the certificate workload. But we have a lot of work to do, and we'll talk more about how we're thinking of streamlining processes. We talked earlier about one of the ways, because of the allocation pictures that I showed, of moving water rights around is through a water right transfer, where you can move the water right from one place to another, or the point of diversion from one place to another. And this is a snapshot of our water right transfer workload. And you can see that right now we have over 700 water right transfers pending, applications pending at the department. We've had about a one-third increase in the number of applications that we've received over the last few years. So the applications coming in have increased by about one-third. We're trying to keep up with them, but you can see that we have a workload building up.
Let's take a second and talk about this, which represents a potential problem, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
We have a growing number of unresolved transfer requests. How much of that, what are the causes for this, and for the, it appears there's also a growth in the number of requests as well as in the number of the backlog. What's the reasoning that you have for the growth in the number of requests? Or do you have comments on that?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I think there's multiple reasons for the backlog of transfer applications continuing to grow. The obvious one, of course, is that the number of applications continue to rise, the ones that are coming in. I think the other issue is that as we have a backlog that begins to grow, and you go back and you look at the application, it becomes more time-consuming for staff and the applicants to remember and to go back and rehash what it is they were trying to do originally. But I think the root of that problem is that there's a lot of work that needs to be done both with the department and the potential water users and the folks that put those applications together, the certified water rights examiners, to do a little bit better job of making a complete and clear application for the department to process. So it's sort of a continuing increase in applications and sort of a leveling off of the quality that are brought to the department. And I think you recognize, Chair Jensen, that the transfers in some cases are getting more complicated because of the different interests and views of how a transfer should proceed. So I think it's kind of multiple reasons that the backlog continues to grow. Having stated all the problems, let me talk a minute about some of the solutions that we hope to implement. One of those, of course, is that we are, as the director indicated earlier, looking for ways to streamline process, both our organization, our sort of decision making, and our standards in terms of how we review transfers, looking for ways to bring field staff into the Salem office and really up our production. But in addition to that, you did talk earlier about our fee adjustment bill that we're proposing. And that will give the department some additional resources to process transfers. It wasn't until 1997 that we actually had field staff helping with the processing of water right transfers. So that's really helped our production. But the fee adjustment would help the department gain about two additional staff resources to move through the water right transfer backlog. And so that's part of the solution. The other part of the solution is working with our stakeholders and to build partnerships in terms of getting a better quality application put together to the department that we can move through quickly, because we do understand the need for a quick and decisive answer from the department.
In the last session, memory has it that we did a bill to expedite some transfers in relationship, I think, to especially irrigation.
Irrigation districts, right.
You know, it's a, and my question and concern, I guess, is are there potentially some other areas where we need, you know, the department and this committee need to look to for changes in the existing statutes to be able to allow us to expedite some of these transfers?
Well, Chair Jensen, our, it's real timely that you ask that. Our Rule Advisory Committee, what we proposed through our administrative rulemaking that's out right now was what they all could agree to and what we could do under current statute. Now, they're going to come to our commission meeting February 13th and 14th, I believe, on the 13th, and identify areas where they couldn't agree that may require some statutory changes. So we'll have that conversation with the water users. And
where's that meeting?
That meeting, I'm sorry, sir, that meeting will be here in Salem.
Okay.
And we'll certainly let you know when that occurs.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question in regard, and perhaps you could educate me, going back to 1997 on the chart. Mm-hmm. The blue indicating transfers filed, and that's 228. Then final orders on the transfers that are filed, that's 200. You completed 249, and yet there's 540 pending. So is that a carryover from prior years? And every year here represents a carryover from prior years.
Chair Jensen, Representative Flores, yes, it does, and it. The final orders may have been for an application that was submitted 2 years ago or so. Right. So you're right. In the yellow bar is kind of what we call the backlog, and that's what we're trying to reduce.
Thank you.
We just follow up here. We would like to you know, work very closely with you, as I know you will with us, on this issue of any possible legislation that understanding that that legislation will ultimately in some corners be controversial or likely be controversial. But, I mean, if one of the things about the transfers is it's a better management, the ability to be able to do some of these things results in a better management of the resources for us. And so at least I feel very strongly that we try to give the users all of the tools that they need to best manage this scarce resource.
Right.
And I will look forward to hearing from you after that commission meeting in February.
We'll get a copy of the agenda item that will describe some of these issues around all the committee members as well.
Thank you.
Commissioner Agenda.
To give you an idea, I talked about the water rights being a lifelong commitment. I also talked about the water rights being distributed all over the state. This is just to give you an idea of how they're distributed. It might be surprising for some of you that the highest number of water rights by county is in right here in Marion County. We also have quite a number in the Douglas County area. And you can also see on the east side of the state, we have some really high numbers, Malheur, Harney, Baker County as well, and in the Umatilla area.
Representative Scotty, please.
Yeah. This, again, just total water rights, this by type, just to give you an idea again how they're distributed. And I think what this really points out is it kind of gives you a feel for where groundwater is a very viable resource and where surface water is a very viable resource. For example, if you looked in the Douglas County area, you can see that while there's over 5,000 water rights, only 94 or so are for groundwater. So that gives a pretty good example that groundwater is probably not a very good option in the Douglas County area. Conversely, if you look in the Marion County area, you can see that almost half of the water rights, or more than half of the water rights, are from groundwater, showing that really is a good viable resource in this part of the state. So again, the water rights are here forever, and they're all over the state. I just wanted to just quickly run through this slide showing you the distribution of water wells in the state of Oregon. There's over 200,000 wells that we have record of around the state, and this shows you how they're distributed. And you can see, of course, in the valley here, pretty high concentration of wells that have been constructed. And the next slide, again, just to show you the distribution of water diversion in the state. Again, quite a bit in the valley, and then again over on the east side.
And with that, we've just got two more, and we just discussed a lot of these as we've gone through, but we just wanted to identify for the committee some of the key issues that we're dealing with. We talked about the workload, focusing a lot on transfers and certificates. Obviously, like I said, we're catching up with the rest of the West in terms of being a fully appropriated state, but we also are a growing state, so we need to find ways to accommodate the new demands for water by being as creative and comprehensive as possible. We're looking at fee adjustments. We try to match our fees to the service that's provided as well as the value that's added. A water right's a property right. A water right property with a water right has a substantial increase in market value relative to property that doesn't have a water right. In the agricultural arena, it can run from $2,000 to $3,000 an acre or more. We know that some of the homes that we're dealing with over on like Wohink Lake, when they had a problem that was identified that they didn't have water rights, all of a sudden some of their market value was dropping out from under them. We're working hard with them to try to address that. But there is a substantial asset value to a water right, and our fees are, as Adam indicated, kind of one-time fees that buy you the services of the department in perpetuity. We're looking at process streamlining and partnerships. How can we work smarter? Klamath adjudication is a key issue for us. We've had some real success in the Klamath adjudication. About 70% of the contests have been resolved in the last 2 years. We've got a few major ones that are still on the horizon, the tribal claims, the Bureau project claims, but we're hopeful that the cooperation that we've seen between the claimants and those who've contested claims will spill over into the big ones as well. It is real key for us to complete that adjudication so we can use the tools that we've got to move water around in that basin. In 2001, we essentially, with the Bureau's decision not to deliver water to the project, essentially the most productive farmland in the basin was dried up, while farmland above the lake continued to be irrigated, and those irrigators may have been willing to work with their other farmers in the basin to move water around. Until we complete the adjudication, we can't move it around.
Mr. Chair, I have a question pertaining to that. How many FTE do we have dedicated to the Klamath adjudication, and do we get any matching federal funds or Bureau of Rec, from Bureau of Rec, say, or
right,
especially since this is a bi-state issue?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, we've, in terms of FTE, it involves both us and the Department of Justice. I think we've had three in the past. That's solely dedicated.
And then, of course, a lot of my time and other people's time work on it as well. We're looking at two at our level. We've got two in the Department of Justice. We use the hearing officer panel for the hearings. I'd have to go through and I can get you a more exact number. In terms of water management, we had a lot of FTEs that were involved in water management activities down the basin, particularly during the 2001 drought. The adjudication has got about 700 claims in it, 750 or so. About 400 of them are federal claims. So we've always felt that we're doing a lot of work that potentially is going to benefit federal agencies. Unfortunately, they don't pay fees in the adjudication, unlike other claimants. Now, here recently, they have been willing to work with us to put money into some of our other water resource activities, our groundwater study, diversion inventories, water right mapping, and so forth. That has allowed us to continue the pace with the limited general fund that we've got for the adjudication, because we're aggressively seeking that kind of funding from the federal government. They're reluctant to pay fees because our adjudication pales compared to adjudications like the Snake River Basin one that's got 76,000 claims or so, and the Yakima Basin and other adjudications throughout the West. Again, I guess I can't emphasize enough the importance of us continuing the pace. We passed the silver anniversary. We started this adjudication in 1976. Now, it got stopped three different times by major lawsuits with the federal government. What we call a DARE 1 and a DARE 2 involving the tribal claims, and then U.S. v. Oregon, where they challenged whether our adjudication process was up to snuff, met the requirements of the McCarran Amendment. That finally got resolved in 96. So we started hitting it hard, picked it back up and started hitting it hard in 96, and we've really made some progress, we've got some major claims out there, and some of those we're hoping to negotiate some settlements on, because I don't want to be in another 10 to 15 years of litigation and not be able to use the water management and water distribution tools that we've got. It's one that we'll, I'm sure, have a number of conversations with you as we go through the session.
Representative Dinkelder brings up a very important, I think, complicating issue in the climate basin, and if we can ask a little beyond this in terms of the partnership or lack thereof with the state of California, since a goodly portion of the climate basin does go into California, and of course the point of the resource is basically in Oregon, and so could you help maybe with a little explanation of what help we're getting or what's taking place as far as the big 800-pound gorilla to the south of us?
We've got an 800-pound gorilla to the south of us, so that must mean an 8,000-pound gorilla to the east of us with the federal government. But we are adjudicating that portion of the Klamath project that is in California, because the diversion for it takes place in Oregon. We adjudicate to the point of diversion. So about a third or more, maybe 40% of the Klamath project and some of the most productive land is actually across the border in California. We'll give you a map of the Klamath, and you might appreciate how we store some water in California in Clear Lake and use it in Oregon. We store some water in Oregon and use it in California, and we kind of run water north, south, east, west through the project down there. So the state line gets kind of blurred, but I can tell you when I'm down there and people are asking, what's California doing? What about the wells that California's drilled? Why isn't California paying attention to diversions down on some of the tributaries, the Scott and Shasta? Why is it that the Klamath project and water coming out of Oregon is expected to be sustain the flows when so much of the Trinity River down in California has been diverted over into the Sacramento. And we try to tell people that, you know, the problems in the Klamath are basin-wide. The solutions have got to be basin-wide as well. We do work with the state of California on a regular basis. They're not funding activities in Oregon, unfortunately, but they're starting to get under the gun as well, and we're glad to see that. You know, it seems like the federal government is willing to cast a wider net, if you will, rather than just put the target on the back of the project irrigators. This is potentially could be a tough year, though. Last I looked, I think we were about 80% of average snowpack. This is some critical time period for the Klamath.
That's why my first question was asked. I mean, you're dropping the ball and you're trying to carry, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're working on that.
Okay.
Final slide. Again, Klamath adjudication. Understand the resource. We do a lot of work on identifying the surface groundwater interaction. We completed a major groundwater study in the Deschutes. We're completing one down in the Klamath and in the Willamette, and hopefully down the road getting ready to go back up into the Umatilla area. Long-term water supply. Obviously, the water's lifeblood of western states, including Oregon, and we need to have a comprehensive program that addresses our water supply needs. A program that looks at the roles of surface and groundwater storage, conservation, transfers, efficiencies, elimination of waste, anything we can do to ensure that the water that we have available to us we're using as wisely as possible, and where we've got opportunities to increase the flexibility of that by storing it in one time a year, using it another time a year, or moving it around is in our long-term interests. And then finally, we try to add value with our processes, and our water users are obviously faced with challenges in terms of Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act compliance, and those are some of the things that we're trying to do through coordination with other agencies, through our flow restoration programs, make sure that we help people as much as we can in terms of both complying with their existing conditions of their water right, as well as getting some benefits in terms of cross-compliance with these other federal statutes. And with that, that's our overview. We have tried to schedule meetings with all the committee members. We're certainly interested in hearing from you what you've heard from constituents, what are some suggestions. We've got a good handle on a lot of the problems. It's the solutions that we're kind of struggling with, so we're certainly interested in working with you on those.
We're from the government. We're here to help you. Thank you very much for your presentation today. Representative Dinkfelder.
Before we adjourn, this is not a question for the panel, so this is something for you, so I don't know if we're finished with these gentlemen.
The panel? Good point. Thank you again very much.
Okay, thanks, sir.
We will see you again.
We will.
Yes, Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair, as Vice Chair, I had something for you today for your tenure at the committee, but since you're going to be leaving us for a little bit, I thought it might be appropriate for you to take it with you. And originally, I was going to pass on my fish pistol for you in case any of the members became unruly. However, I think in your next journey,
can I reach that?
You might need this, you know, to keep the nurses and doctors in check. So I thought it was a little present for you to remember us.
I will take this with me.
And it is currently unloaded, so I wanted to. So I hope you'll think of us as your recuperation.
And
we're looking forward to having you back here soon.
We thank you and appreciate that. And from a very selfish point of view, I'm looking forward to being back here very soon, sort of thing. And I appreciate the committee is being left, you know, in good hands with the Representative Dinkfelder and Representative Krupp. And I'm sure that staff will not let either of them do anything that the staff knows that I wouldn't want done.
There's the person coming in that you need to, oh, sorry.
Yes, I know. We pretty well have already identified the targets, so. With no other items then before the committee, we will be adjourned for this 21st day of January 03.